Paper 12. Right at the beginning, on old single column, page 128. Okay, let's see. I think what we'll want to do here is remind ourselves of what I was bringing up right at the end last time, about the title of this paper. Over the years, you know, you may have had a tendency to kind of just let the universe of universes express and sort of just, you know, pass in one ear and out the other and not really give it much thought. But, this is a good time to really, you know, allow yourself to appreciate what's behind that. It's a lot more than just taking the biblical heaven of heavens expression and recasting it into a, you know, fifth epical context. You want to really begin to appreciate the word universe. And now it is true, as we'll see as we get into this, that you have a sort of a modern use of the word universe that they that they engage, that they use as part of the on-ramp for the revelation. In that sense, you have, you know, like the current, just, you know, the word that we use to describe everything, you know, the universe. You know, we use the word universe that way. You know, just a very nondescript word to say everything that's out there. And then back in the early days, which you'll see them touching on here too, of beginning to discover galaxies. Once they recognized that you had these massive star systems that were way outside of the Milky Way, they were initially designating them island universes. And you're using the word universe in a little bit more of its true spirit there. Remember, you know, literally, in Latin, the word universe, you know, uni is meaning one. You know, so, it's one turning. You know, that Latin root that we use, like in versus, or like they use in uversa, and, you know, or in vice versa. You know, the word verse, you know, in English, turning. It comes from the Latin word to turn. Okay, so it's one turning. So in other words, in some, you know, the spirit of the coinage of the word is that in some sense what you're talking about has a measure of self-contained nature. You know, it's relatively self-contained in some sense. You know, so everything can kind of be all together there in one turning. You don't really have to go outside of that to get what you need. You see these big star systems out there all by themselves, like, well, that's a little universe unto itself. It's this island universe. And on top of that, of course, and you're looking out there, a lot of those things that you see out there are literally big worlds, you know, they're spiral galaxies, they're one turning. Okay, so, you know, it was a very appropriate term to describe them as island universes. And in that sort of just kind of basic physical sense, the revelators sometimes will use the expression universe of universes, where the of universes part is just, in a very generic, you know, in maybe basically physical sense of all these sort of separate systems that you might observe or delineate. Nevertheless, there's an envelope around the whole thing. It's a universe of universes. And that first universe, no matter what the of universes refers to, definitely that universe, you know, dot, 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 that use of the word universe is you know, you want to really appreciate in more of the solid fifth epical sense of, in a very definitive, deity-imposed way. You have a whole, W-H-O-L-E, nature, a holistic nature to what you're pointing at and calling a universe. So even if you're going to, you know, look out in the outer space levels and say, wow, look at all those island universes, look at all those universes, all those physical universes, even then, you know, recognized or not, discernible or not, in some way, there's an encompassing of all of that. And that's certainly the spirit of saying Master Universe. Okay. That even though out in the outer space levels it's you know apparently just physical, you know, essentially physical processes, that's all within a top-down deity-encompassed and deity-filled context. And of course that latter part, the deity-filled, that's you know what we've been trying to really begin to appreciate more, that you don't just have God as transcendence, some deity fact outside that encompasses, you know, he's got the whole world in his hands sort of a thing, but there's deity within. There's God as immanence also, you know, that pervades that whole space. And very much that you want to you want to begin to really recognize that if the revelators say Master Universe, Grand Universe, Central Universe, Super Universe, Local Universe, there's a womb of experiential deity there. There's a womb of the mother there, and that's fundamentally what holds that together as a relatively self-contained fact. That's the individuality of that whole. That's the mother. And so, so I'm bringing it full circle then. You know, okay, universe of universes. You know, notice the context in which they use it. It's not always in kind of just that general sort of thing where it's just trying to kind of a catch-all term for the whole gobbledygook of what's inside the Master Universe. You know, all these weird galaxies doing all kinds of weird things out in the outer space level. Sometimes it's being used very more specifically to what's within the Grand Universe. Not so much as a synonym for the Grand Universe, but for what's within that, that's a little issue that we've tried to begin to appreciate. That yeah, you have a local universe, and you have a super universe, but there is a domain in between an individual super universe and the whole grand universe. In other words, the womb of the universal mother. There's something in between the two. There's a wholeness to just the collection of 700,000 local universes, transcendent of an individual super universe. You know, so not 100,000 plus one, but just 700,000. Okay. And why is there something that's transcendent of a master spirit's super universe domain like that? The key is the Ancients of Days. Don't forget about the Ancients of Days. It's easy to kind of lose sight of them a lot of times. But they're extremely important to the big picture. In many ways, they're on equal footing with the master spirits. In some senses, they're even above the master spirits. It depends on the context that you're speaking of. And an example of them really kind of functioning above the master spirits is what I'm alluding to here. Because the master spirits, as a self, as a deity fact, each of the seven is distinct. Yeah, they have seven unique personalities. But personality aside, what's being personalized, there's seven distinct facts. And that's what gives the seven, distinct individual characters to the seven super universes. Above and beyond the personal distinction. Okay. But the 21 Ancients of Days, three at the head of each super universe, those 21 Ancients of Days don't have a self, a deity nature that is distinct one from the other. The 21 personalities are absolutely unique, but their deity nature is the same. And so collectively, those 21 Ancients of Days establish a collective transcendent of the super universe, overarching sort of engagement of the whole. Okay? And their agencies, their mother agencies, the creative mother agencies of the Ancients of Days, establish a womb of the whole. Below the universal mother and the grand universe, but above the super universes. And that there's a universe of local universes. So a lot of times when they say universe of universes, that's what you should read between the lines. Forget about the outer space levels, it's not inhabited. It's just focusing on the present age. What we really have is a universe of local universes. God, see, it's not just a collection, it's a universe of local universes. There is a mother fact that encompasses all 700,000 together. It's a universe of local universes. Okay? So it's a complex term, this universe of universes. And so you always want to, be on your feet and think about what it is that they're, using it for. If you try to use it in a simplistic way, it's like, well, it always just means everything. Well, then you're going to misinterpret a lot of sentences. So there's a lot of sentences that use that. They're not referring to the outer space levels. And if you bring them in, you're going to misunderstand the context of the sentence or the paragraph. So I know that seemed like a lot to say about just the title, but it's an important point. Really what they're doing with that term. Okay, so we're going to start us off. We're really getting into the cosmology here now. And it's pretty straightforward to begin with. Let's just jump in and everyone can get reminded of the basic geometry of the big picture of the master universe.
Paper 12, The Universe of Universes. The immensity of the far-flung creation of the Universal Father is utterly beyond the grasp of finite imagination. The enormousness of the Master Universe staggers the concept of even my order of being. But the mortal mind can be taught much about the plan and arrangement of the universes. You can know something of their physical organization and marvelous administration. You may learn much about the various groups of intelligent beings who inhabit the seven super universes of time and the central universe of eternity. In principle, that is, in eternal potential, we conceive of material creation as being infinite because the Universal Father is actually infinite. But as we study and observe the total material creation, we know that at any given moment in time, it is limited. although to your finite minds it is comparatively limitless, virtually boundless. We are convinced from the study of physical law and from the observation of the starry realms that the infinite creator is not yet manifest in finality of cosmic expression, that much of the cosmic potential of the infinite is still self-contained and unrevealed. To created beings, the master universe might appear to be almost infinite, but it is far from finished. There are still physical limits to the material creation, and the experiential revelation of the eternal purpose is still in progress.
Pretty basic, straightforward. Did you notice in that first paragraph, we can be taught, and we can know, and we may learn. It seems to be suggestive of more of the revelatory limitations there. And not only are you able to learn and know some things, but we're permitted to reveal some things too about the various groups of intelligent beings who inhabit the seven super universes. And just to all these little things they throw in there like that. All right, so there's the intro, pretty straightforward. Then they just give you the big overview. So the master universe, what's the basic structure of it?
Oh,
okay.
Here for total deity, mm-hmm. self-contained.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Third paragraph.
Yeah. The
potential of the infinite is still self-contained and unrevealed.
And so self-contained deity is which one?
It's the universal one of infinity.
Universal one of infinity. And that the universal one of infinity has two sides. The first center and the Paradise Trinity. In this sense, thinking of the potential of it all, you have two facts stemming from those two sides of self-contained deity, father side and the mother side of things. So, just to say that, if you're really noticing the details, they're reminding you that the father and the mother have much yet to express.
That's interesting phraseology. Cosmic potential of the infinite.
Mm-hmm.
Because the infinite is self-existent deity.
And one of the things you got to remember, sometimes, and really kind of in this particular case, if you're thinking in a sort of a time sequence like way, about the way they describe the story up in paper 105. They kind of go from the infinite to the infinite one, the infinity to the infinity, and then to the seven facets, sevenfold deity of the I Am, and then to the seven absolutes of infinity. As they tell that story in sort of an imaginary sequence. And so So sometimes when they use the expression the infinite, they aren't necessarily meaning technically in the sense of the 14 facets of, the fundamental 14 facets of total deity. Sometimes it's more than that. It's almost like saying the I Am. In other words, that beginning stage of your thought is still bottled up. But in a more but you don't have to interpret that. I mean, I'm telling you that's they're certainly kind of doing it in that sort of an on-ramp sort of a way. But that doesn't mean that you can't think about it more technically as well. Because one of the things that the infinite is a reservoir. A reservoir of what? A reservoir for what? Life animation, yeah. Life animation. So when you think of when all is said and done and you actually have, the I Am concept unpacked, and you have this facet of deity that you call the infinite, you know, it still remains this infinite reservoir of potential for life, all life, high and low, not just material life, all life. You can think of it that way too, in that more precise way.
This is a great, really a huge understatement. That much of the cosmic potential is still self-contained.
Yeah, in other words, we're a little short of the cosmos infinite.
Full expression.
Yeah. Right, like infinitely short of the cosmos infinite. Yeah.
We're barely in the adolescent stage.
Right. So, yeah, but you know, good for you to notice that. I mean, it, the more you get sort of this spirit of engaging the book, you can see how sentences are constructed so that they're fairly gentle on ramp kind of sentences, and they can be engaged without having to have a really sophisticated understanding, but they never, construct them as an affront to the precise truth either. Just means you're going to have to, think really, really methodically and clearly, to get it properly. But
1, space levels of the master universe. The universe of universes is not an infinite plane, a boundless cube, nor a limitless circle. It certainly has dimensions. The laws of physical organization and administration prove conclusively that the whole vast aggregation of force energy and matter power functions ultimately as a space unit, as an organized and coordinated whole. The observable behavior of the material creation constitutes evidence of a physical universe of definite limits. The final proof of both a circular and delimited universe is afforded by the, to us, well-known fact that all forms of basic energy ever swing around the curved path of the space levels of the master universe in obedience to the incessant and absolute pull of paradise gravity.
Notice in there, the spirit of what I was saying there about the universe of universes. So even when you're thinking in this very generalized sense of all the matter and everything, this whole vast aggregation of force, energy, and matter power functions ultimately as a space unit, as an organized and coordinated whole. Coordinated, mother word, whole. There's an individuality of the whole. God the ultimate as God the mother is the individuality of the master universe whole. In the present universe age, it's by and large unmanifested, but the individuality of that whole is there nonetheless. And that's what they're referring to. No matter how undeveloped the outer space levels are even to them, they can still tell when all is said and done, there's an individuality to this whole master universe. There's a mother of this whole master universe. All right, and now that beginning, infinite plane, boundless cube, or limitless circle, you could just forget about the revelation sort of picture. Just if you think historically about humans imagining some sort of metaphysical worldview in which they're going to try to interpret everything. Notions like this have certainly been played with over the centuries, millennia. The word plane is, a spiritual plane. We've used that for ages. The boundless cube is when you start bringing in more of a structured Cartesian type thinking, and you're literally thinking X, Y, and Z axes, okay? The notion of how everything is some sort of a big cycle, that limitless circle. So taking planes and Cartesian space and circles, you could just take it historically, and say, it's not any of those sort of concepts taken to the nth degree. It's limitless, boundless, or, you know. Okay. But of course, you be perspective. You know, we know there is kind of a plane, you know, to pervaded space. And we know things go in big circuits. And there is a circle, you know, aspect to it. And it also is a three-dimensional space. So, I mean, you know, you can look at it both ways. I mean, it's another example. See, if you're not really thinking in UB terms, if you're thinking more historically, there it's a very on-ramp sort of a sentence. Sort of a little bit for everyone's metaphysical viewpoint there. But it's also, you know, can be taken just very specifically. Yeah, and that's of course what they do when they say, you know, when they bring back the circular, the final proof of both a circular, but not limitless circle, you know, circular and delimited. So, you know, it's interesting of those three, which do they choose to really hold up? You know, if you have kind of a linkage to a historical perspective on how to think about rationalizing reality. They don't choose what you might think is kind of the modern scientific thing of a Cartesian coordinate system, you know, and then just say, well, there's structure inside of that Cartesian coordinate system. And they also don't say, well, it's a plane, but it's kind of thick in spots. You know, they really want, you know, they want you to appreciate the not just the fact of the circle, but the truth of the circle. You know, and holding that as sort of a primal thought, that no matter how vast it is, there is a circularity to it all. Oh, that feeds right back to the title of the paper, One Turning. No matter how vast, no matter how confusing, you know, what you're thinking about, when all is said and done, there's one turning. There's a it comes back on itself. There's a central point. There's an individuality of that circumference, of that whole. Okay. And so that, you know, why don't you just appreciate that? I mean, they're doing a lot more there than if you're really kind of really stuck in a UB mode, that, you know, then you would realize. You got to remember to think about the whole of human history and all the thoughts that humans have had, and how they're trying to take what humans have thought and uplift the most useful element. You know, the circularity is a fundamental truth about the nature of reality.
So nebulae. They're all spinning around paradise, and they don't go out of orbit, or do they ever spin out of orbit, or are they always going around?
They'll comment here in a little bit. I mean, the whole master universe comes back around on itself. Yeah.
Nothing gets away. That's amazing.
Yeah. Not even a photon. You know, nary an ultimaton gets away.
Physics went into that.
Yeah. And a thing called the aisle.
Even those alternating things keep alternating,
sure,
you know,
right.
Space motions keep it from,
right,
traveling.
It keeps it from getting all jumbled up. But, you know, but when all is said and done, the fact that you have an aisle, everything must, you know, acknowledge its centrality.
But then like an asteroid or something that gets loose, what about that?
Doesn't it get loose from the master universe?
But it gets loose inside. I mean, there's the gravity.
Things get loose from local things all the time, but that's local gravity. Nothing gets loose from absolute gravity.
The successive space levels of the master universe constitute the major divisions of pervaded space. Total creation, organized and partially inhabited, or yet to be organized and inhabited. If the master universe were not a series of elliptical space levels of lessened resistance to motion, alternating with zones of relative quiescence, we conceive that some of the cosmic energies would be observed to shoot off on an infinite range, off on a straight line path into trackless space. But we never find force, energy, or matter thus behaving. Ever they whirl, always swinging onward in the tracks of the great space circuits.
It's almost like the answer to the thought that Pam just had in the next paragraph. Right, so, you know, there it is, like they're saying. I mean, not even force, you know, let alone energy or power. Nothing. Nothing gets away. Let's just stress again, since it's come up some recently, this whole bit about elliptical space levels of lessened resistance to motion, just the way they say that, note that. In other words, what is the what's sort of the initial state that they're getting, they're wanting to imagine there? It's an iron grip of resistance, the static level, okay? The motionless of the aisle, you know, paradise, and then there's domains where that grip is loosened, okay. And that is kind of the spirit of the word quiescence. That, yeah, it means it's quiet, but why? Is it just innately so? Or is it quieted? Quiescence really implies that you know, if something is quiescent, it's that way, it's quiet because it's been quieted. Something has stilled the storm. Something has a grip on it. Okay. So that's why they use that word quiescence, you know, to describe the domains where there's lessened resistance. You know, that's where there is resistance to motion. Something has a hold of it.
In a material thing, we call that a lubricant. To allow for easier to free it up so it can move.
But in the sense of the unqualified absolute, and how they remember how they often describe that as very static as an idea. That this whole bit about manifesting the cosmos is about setting it free from the stasis, you know, loosing the ties that bind. You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. The whole universe is actually like that, in going from potentials to actuals. It's locked, you know, in the cosmic potential of the infinite. And over time, over a long, vast sequence, it's being let loose from the grip. Okay? So just you appreciate there's all those subtle things that they want you to really change the way you think about the universe that you live in. You know, bring in the rigor of a modern fact-based scientific mind, but don't expunge it of poetry. You know, there's a beauty and a truth to the cosmos that you live in. It's not just a cold universe in the sense that we use the word universe these days. It's a cosmos, you know, the cosmic potentials. It's fundamentally this, this, I don't know, just a domain that has quality to it, you know, beauty to it, flavor to it. Make sure you begin to feel that flavor, incorporate that flavor of the universe that you live in into your being, so that it's an unspoken truth that you live. You live your life knowing that God is all about loosening the ties that bind. If you will supply the favorable conditions, He will loosen the ties that bind, and you will be set free. The freedom that you yearn for is the basic nature of reality. But He's given you absolute control over this. You can prevent those ties that bind from being loosened.
Yep. A lot of times we have to live by faith.
But again, you want to grow that faith into living faith. You want to set faith free. That whole, the whole notion of living by faith is in shackles in a human history of thought. It's a very limited notion. It suffers from a lack of the fifth epical revelation. It labors under fear. You need to fear not. You need to choose to fear not so that your faith can be set free from the bondage it's in as being merely an antidote for fear. It's not living faith. It's in chains. Now, I just brought that up because I want you to see that in what we're talking about, when they talk about things like, lessened resistance to motion, that's not just about material things. It's a universal principle appreciated in the big context of everything. And just, they don't always put the adjective on the word in the book. If it just says faith in a sentence in the book, you need to ask yourself, does it imply genuine living faith, this sentence? If you interpret it in the simplistic, old-fashioned notion of faith way, you'll misunderstand that sentence. You'll think it's a sentence about magic, about how the Father does magical things for you, just like you always have wanted. And it's a pleasing fable. The Father's magical stuff, if you just have this faint flicker of faith. I mean, yes, a faint flicker of faith gets you going, but just, most of the time, if it's a profound sentence, it's talking about living faith, not mere faith. So, all right. Let's see. Yeah, here we are. We got this, the mass, so total creation, organized and partially inhabited, or yet to be organized and inhabited. It's very much this, this very general universe of universes picture that we're in. Okay, but everything swings around these tracks.
Proceeding outward from paradise through the horizontal extension of pervaded space, the master universe is existent in six concentric ellipses. The space levels encircling the central aisle. 1, the central universe, Havona. 2, the 7 superuniverses. 3, the first outer space level. 4, the second outer space level. 5, the third outer space level. And 6, the fourth and outermost space level.
Okay, just very trivially, there's obviously something missing there. The number 7. Every list has 7 in it.
Paradise.
Well, no. 7, something out beyond the fourth. 7 is obviously missing from the list. Okay, what is 7? Okay, if you go beyond the absonite to the co-absolute, okay, there has to be more to the story. Yeah, I mean, they were alluding to it in the beginning. We conceive of material creation as being infinite because the universal Father is actually infinite. Okay? There has to be a cosmos infinite. There has to be a rest of the story that goes beyond item number 6. There has to be an item number 7. Okay, the trans-absonite domain. Okay? Yeah, that's. I mean, it's just a simple. It's just screaming at you. You know that every time you see a list in here, it's got 7 items in it. The fact that it stops short of 7, you know that the fourth outer space level can't be the last word in Testament.
Real stuff starts. Right. Number 7.
Right, in the cosmos infinite, the tiny little nucleus at the center is the master universe. Yeah. Right? And just one other thing there, as long as the list is right there, 1, 2, 3, 4 levels. Why are there 4 outer space levels? Okay. It's one of those things that you don't really notice unless you carefully look at paper 30. Yeah, a paper that you often skip, I'm sure. Right now we have finite facts striving for supremacy. The next age is not just a singular age where you have absolute facts striving for ultimacy. There's 4 levels of ultimate personality activity. You get to that, the final completeness of God the ultimate in 4 stages. So it's, there's 7 levels of the absonite, but there's 4 levels of ultimate personality activity identified with that absonite. That's why there's 4 outer space levels. Yeah?
Isn't there 4 stages of spirit?
I mean, in terms of you being an ascender?
Right.
No, there's 7. Just keep that in mind. Don't let it just be, there's 4, I don't know why, just whatever. I mean, it has a very, everything, you want to be able to answer the question why about everything. Why are there 4 levels? Because there's 4 levels of ultimate personality activity. All right, let's move out through them here.
The central universe is not a time creation. It is an eternal existence. This never-beginning, never-ending universe consists of 1 billion spheres of sublime perfection and is surrounded by the enormous dark gravity bodies. At the center of Havona is the stationary and absolutely stabilized Isle of Paradise, surrounded by its 21 satellites. Owing to the enormous encircling masses of the dark gravity bodies about the fringe of the central universe, the mass content of this central creation is far in excess of the total known mass of all 7 sectors of the grand universe. The Paradise Havona system. The eternal universe encircling the eternal isle constitutes the perfect and eternal nucleus of the master universe. All 7 of the super universes and all regions of outer space revolve in established orbits around this gigantic central aggregation of the Paradise satellites and the Havona spheres.
Okay, so remember what they told us, if you want to think very precisely, technically about this. I mean, the isle is not part of the central universe. The central universe is the Paradise Havona system. It's the 10 circuits, 7 Havona circuits, 3 Paradise circuits, and the dark gravity bodies. That's the central universe. The isle is outside of the central universe. But be aware that they don't always speak hyper precisely like that, because this they need this book to be approachable by people initially that are just trying to wrap their mind. So like that, and they told you that. It says a lot of times we just talk about the aisle as being, because it's easier for the beginning student to literally think of it there and not to try to wrap your mind around something that's not in space and all this sort of stuff. Okay. Yeah. But technically, The central universe is the 10 circuits. Okay, it's not just Havona. It's the central universe. You know, there's the central universe, and then a subset of the central universe is Havona, the billion worlds in the 7 circuits. And then there's also the dark gravity bodies and the 3 paradise circuits.
Yeah, I noticed the 6, and I thought there must be a 7. But I took the easy answer, paradise.
Yeah, but paradise would go 0. You know, there's a 0, yeah. That's the Isle of Paradise, okay. There's a foundation. Yeah. Okay, so Paradise Savona system is and the dark gravity bodies. That's the central universe.
The 7 super universes are not primary physical organizations. Nowhere do their boundaries divide a nebular family. Neither do they cross a local universe, a prime creative unit. Each super universe is simply a geographic space clustering of approximately 1/7 of the organized and partially inhabited post-Havona creation. And each is about equal in the number of local universes embraced and in the space encompassed. Nebadon, your local universe, is one of the newer creations of Vorvontan, the 7th super universe.
Okay, so we have the central universe. And then outside of that, there's this great big toroidal, donut-like region of space, you know, surrounding the central universe. And that donut of space is chopped into 7 segments. So there's 7 segments of that donut of space. Each one of those segments is a super universe. That's the super universe, that segment of pervaded space. And then within that little, you know, delimited region, things are being initiated. Nebulae are being initiated. They're slowly being organized into one central structure, in our case, the Milky Way galaxy. So, you know, when they say that, nowhere does a nebular family cross the boundaries or cut through, you know, the boundary doesn't cut through a local universe. Okay, I mean, why? It's because the domain is established and then stuff is done inside that domain. And it's limited to be within that domain. Okay, because it's all controlled. Okay, so that's the, you know, to make sure you appreciate that a super universe is not just the central galactic system. It's that whole segment of toroidal space.
What's
toroid? A torus, a donut. Okay. Okay. And so, in the most general sense, if they're talking about a super universe, they may be talking about something, you know, a part of that region of space that's not literally down in the galaxy in the center. It could be something happening over here, you know, away from the disk of the central large galaxy. That's still part of the super universe, just not the very organized part. Okay.
Is what we call the Milky Way what they're calling Nebadon?
No. No. That's the Milky Way is Orvandon. I mean, technically Orvandon is this segment of space. But there's one large galactic-like structure in that segment of the donut. It's a great big spiral galaxy called the Milky Way Galaxy. Just that one galaxy. Orvandon is the name
of our
super universe. In that segment of space, there's, you know, basically in the center of it, there's one big galaxy, the Milky Way galaxy, and a few little things scattered around it that are also within that segment of space. And that's it. That's the super universe. And you'll see that, you know, if we go forward, they state that many, many, many times.
Basically, the Milky Way is way bigger than our astronomers think.
Well, I mean, not I don't think in the sense you're thinking. It's bigger than our astronomers think, but not. It's you know, let's say it's 10 times bigger.
Because they see all kinds of things out there that they say are 100 million light years across, the size of our Milky Way.
What, no, the outer space levels is where all those galaxies are that everyone sees, right?
So, in other words, what they're seeing out there, all those things that they're determining are about 100,000 light years across, and they think that's about how big the Milky Way is.
You know, how big actually?
So many of them.
How big actually? You know, is the see it depends. Like I said, I mean, bigger depends on what dimension you're talking about. I mean, in terms of the, you know, what do they tell you about the basic diameter of the Milky Way galaxy? They tell you it's about 500,000 light years. Rather than what science thinks. So, you know, like say 5 times bigger,
okay.
Say.
So, okay. So it would be 10 times bigger than they're thinking.
But also, I mean, they think that we're about, see, it all depends on what number you're talking about. They also think that we're, say, maybe 26,000 light years, I think it is, they think we are from the center. We're actually 200,000. He says, that's a lot bigger. I mean, it all depends on which dimension, because this is something we'll get into as we go forward. Scientists have a lot of confusion about sizes. I'll emphasize it, especially now that this came up as we go forward. I mean, very much just think of this chunk of a donut, the one big galaxy in it, and a few little things scattered around, like. Can anyone give me an example of two of the bigger little things that are in there with the Milky Way?
Andromeda.
No, that's not a little thing, and it's not in there.
Magellanic clouds.
Yeah, large and small Magellanic clouds. Okay, those are part of the of Orvieton. Okay, because they're just right here.
The Isle is outside of Central Universe. So this right here, though, so that contradicts what this says. I don't understand how you can say that. When it says that.
But we've also read, we've read just recently, they said, a lot of times we refer to the Isle as being part of the Central Universe, but it actually isn't. We've read that sentence.
I know,
so we know that. They're just, I mean, for ease of discussion, you often, like they said, I mean, you often refer to the Isle as being there. Okay? Conceptually, it's there. It's not like you go to the fourth outer space level to stand on the Isle of Paradise. You go to the center of Avona. Okay? Okay. So, because of what I just said there, that's why they usually refer to the Isle as being there. Because the Isle is an absolute fact. Okay? The Isle is an absolute fact. But the space you're navigating in Avona is basically an absonite fact. Below the absolute. So if you think in simple sort of like plane-like pictures, you're walking around on an absonite plane, but the Isle is not an absonite fact, so it's not going to be in that plane. It's up. You have to take a step up to the Isle. So, you know, if you look at it from the top down in that picture, okay, the Isle looks like it's in the center of Havona. But if you look at it from the side, no, it's above Havona. Okay, it's in that philosophic sense. See, it's not literally in; it's above. If you take everything up to the infinite level, okay, then everything is on one plane, and it's actually there. Okay, it's the absolute nucleus of that infinite cosmos. Okay, but see, it's a simple example of you have to have a sophisticated engagement of the revelation. It's not written, it's just like Jesus's parables.
Right. You can't.
If you're a real simple-minded person listening to Jesus, if you were a very simple-minded person sitting there listening to Jesus, you misunderstood everything he said. Because you were, even his apostles misunderstood everything. Because it's like, no, don't take it simplistically and literally. He'd say to them, can't you think in more complex terms? You know, he'd tell them.
Because they're trying to pin it down very
materialistically. Right. Old wineskin. Right. He's, so the book is the same way. you can, you know, if you treat it, you know, in a simplistic way, it's just going to be nothing but confusion, because it's, you have to step it up, just like Jesus was challenging his listeners to step it up. Yeah.
Colin is in that wedge of the pie wedge where it comes together, a yeah. pervaded space right is. There. It's going to be below paradise. Paradise is going to be above it.
Right. Okay. That's yeah. see, that's another power of that analogy. It kind of allows you to sort of okay. directly well, think well, about that. Even if you don't picture it geometrically like that, with yeah. that analogy, though, the hourglass analogy, just conceptually, it's an absolute fact.
Yeah.
And Avona isn't.
Yeah.
Avona is below an absolute fact. Okay.
Our astronomers have not yet discovered Nevadon. They think we're a part of a much smaller thing.
I mean, our astronomers have no idea of all the internal complexity of the Milky Way galaxy. They think the Milky Way galaxy looks like Andromeda, say. Right. You know, just one big whirl. No, it's extremely complex.
It's flying.
Because it's an aggregate structure. What did they just say? They said the seven superuniverses are not primary physical organizations. You didn't just spin up the Milky Way galaxy like they spun up Andromeda. The Milky Way galaxy is a composite structure. They've spun up all kinds of tiny little things, and they're collecting together into a great big pile, okay? Coordinating it together. Okay. The Milky Way is not a primary creation. You know, especially, you know, when you recognize that the fundamental mother units are the local universes.
So they think we're in the Orion arm, don't they, of the Milky Way?
See, I mean, see, there's a very, you know, you can almost see nothing. Remember, you can barely see past the end of your nose in the galaxy because of all the gas and the dust, okay?
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, if you're going to see any distance, all you're seeing is hydrogen gas. You're seeing the part of Orvinton that is unorganized. If you could see the stuff, if you could see the matter, the stars, you know, you'd see 10 pie wedges of the major sectors. You know, and they said, you know, even if you had really good top-down view on it, you could even see the minor sectors. Okay. I mean, it's a patchwork structure, if you will. Okay, it's not just a big amorphous whirl of hydrogen gas like current science thinks it is. All right.
The grand universe is the present organized and inhabited creation. It consists of the seven superuniverses with an aggregate evolutionary potential of around 7 trillion inhabited planets, not to mention the eternal spheres of the central creation. But this tentative estimate takes no account of architectural administrative spheres. Neither does it include the outlying groups of unorganized universes. The present ragged edge of the grand universe, its uneven and unfinished periphery, together with the tremendously unsettled condition of the whole astronomical plot, suggests to our star students that even the seven superuniverses are as yet uncompleted. As we move from within, from the divine center outward in any one direction, we do eventually come to the outer limits of the organized and inhabited creation. We come to the outer limits of the grand universe. And it is near this outer border, in a far-off corner of such a magnificent creation, that your local universe has its eventful existence.
See that whole bit about it, the outer edge being ragged. You know, that's, you know, that was the subtext of, that they're about equal in the space encompassed. You know, that was the line, and when they're talking about the seven superuniverses. I mean, that the reason it says about is, I mean, initially you have a very definitive equal thing, but as that space between the super universe level and the first outer space level has become less quiescent, you know, it's less of a very definitive canal of nothing, and you know, and it has this ragged edge, and so you know, there's some little bit of difference between sort of the accessible space in each of the seven super universes because of that ragged outer edge. Okay, you have some.
How does the Milky Way compare in size to the Andromeda?
It's about the same size.
That's what I wondered.
Right.
How did they answer you? I didn't hear.
Yeah, it's a point that I've made a number of times over the years. I mean, to really appreciate, that's one of the things that's very mysterious to them about the outer space levels is, you know, by and large, what you see out there, you know, sort of the main units of creation out there are these worlds that are basically the same size as the Milky Way. So it's taking creation up a whole notch. You know, in a super universe, you have lots of little worlds that are collected together into a big world. Out there, sort of they start with a big world, yeah, and then those are collecting together into even bigger things. So, yeah, I mean, it, you know, they can tell that everything is sort of taken up a notch in scale. Let's see. What else did we have in there? Let's see. I know there was something else. I'm losing track of here. What was it that I was going to mention in there? So this tremendously unsettled condition. You know, the more we've learned about the immediate environment of the Milky Way galaxy, the more we're seeing this. These little galaxies that are slowly being drawn into the Milky Way, you know, incorporated into it, you know, some of them are quite tiny. You know, as they get in close, you know, tidally, the Milky Way just starts pulling them apart. And you've got like a galaxy they've discovered now that, you know, basically its guts are wrapped practically all the way around the Milky Way as it's spiraling in. So that kind of unsettled state, see, is what they're alluding to. The master physical controllers have to deal with that. Think about, you know, so you bring in this object and you don't just bring it in neatly like this and sort of like insert it with tweezers carefully somewhere into it. You've got this thing being pulled apart, and so, you know, there's stuff all over. It's going to be wanting to unsettle this very settled local universe over here. Imagine you've got a local universe over here that's settled in light and life. Okay? And then there's stuff, you know, wanting to pull on it. You know, they've got to try to somehow stop that and, you know, marshal the forces. I mean, so it's a very complicated thing. It's not like they can micromanage all of this. A lot of it is just wheeling, you know, and they have to deal with it dynamically. I mean, that's why, remember, they tell you that it's very hard at times, even in this initial stages of our constellation. And Relationship is a pretty wild and woolly place energetically. A lot of times they have a hard time keeping it, you know, sort of within the habitable range because of all this chaos, all this unsettledness that they're alluding to here. Okay, so... All right, so the outer space levels.
The outer space levels. Far out in space, at an enormous distance from the seven inhabited super universes, there are assembling vast and unbelievably stupendous circuits of force and materializing energies. Between the energy circuits of the seven super universes and this gigantic outer belt of force activity, there is a space zone of comparative quiet, which varies in width but averages about 400,000 light years. These space zones are free from stardust, cosmic fog. Our students of these phenomena are in doubt as to the exact status of the space forces existing in this zone of relative quiet, which encircles the seven super universes. But about 500,000 light years beyond the periphery of the present grand universe, we observe the beginnings of a zone of an unbelievable energy action which increases in volume and intensity for over 25 million light years. These tremendous wheels of energizing forces are situated in the first outer space level, a continuous belt of cosmic activity encircling the whole of the known, organized, and inhabited creation.
Okay, so just add that to the picture. So you have the donut of space that the seven super universes are in, then you have a gap around that. Like they said, it's about 400,000 light years thick radially outward. And then out beyond that, you've got the first outer space level, another great big donut, you know, of space all the way around the super universes, you know, vastly bigger, you know, think especially not only a lot radially wider, but, you know, a lot taller too. This gigantic donut, okay, of space going all the way around. And it's 50 million light years thick, radially outward. That's the 25, so it gets thicker and thicker to about the midpoint, and then it density goes down again. Okay. The 25 is the halfway point that they're referring to there. And then it ramps down. Okay. So you've got it's 50 million light years thick, that first outer space level. Okay, and who knows how tall. But, there's a lot of vertical to it as well. Okay, so and you notice that they even kind of gave you sort of a rule of thumb. Forget about the 400,000. It's like, it's roughly 500,000. Okay, roughly 500,000. So you have something that's roughly 500,000, then you have something that's roughly 50 million. So you just take it up a couple notches in the decimal point. Eh?
They're rounding it off a little bit.
Okay. And then, so if that one's roughly 50 million radially thick, then what happens outside of that?
Still greater activities are taking place beyond these regions, for the Uversa physicists have detected early evidence of force manifestations more than 50 million light years beyond the outermost ranges of the phenomena in the first outer space level. These activities undoubtedly presage the organization of the material creations of the second outer space level of the Master Universe.
Okay, see, so you have the first outer space level being 50 million light years thick, and radially, and then there's a like size gap of 50 million light years, and then the second outer space level starts up, ramping up in density of galaxies out beyond that. Okay? So, and the reason that they, another reason why they're wanting to kind of just give you some simple numbers that you can easily hold in your head. Like I said, we don't know exactly how radially thick the super universe donut is, but they do tell you that basically the galaxy is about 500,000. So you see, that's a number, 500,000, then a 500,000 gap, and then 50 million, and then a 50 million gap. See, it's nice, simple, repeated numbers, okay? And then out beyond that, something that's maybe...
Billion.
No. Actually, I'm glad you said that, because the answer is no. That second outer space level is probably about 500 million light years thick. And there are no galaxies a billion light years away. We're going to get to that in a second. All this stuff they think is a billion light years or more, billions of light years, there is no such thing. That's all misunderstanding.
So Carl Sagan.
There's no third out, galaxies in the third outer space level yet. If there were things that were say 3 billion light years away, that'd be out in the third outer space level. There isn't anything out there yet. Okay. What they're misinterpreting as being out there are these very young things that are in the outer parts, like the outer half of the second outer space level. They're very redshifted because they're new state. They misinterpret that as being very far away, but it really isn't. Okay.
Just a quick question. Mm-hmm. In the middle of the last paragraph, our students of this of these phenomena are in doubt as to the exact status of the space forces existing in this zone, or relative quiet, which encircles the seven superunits. What the hell are they talking about?
Okay, so they're talking about. I mean, I was kind of skipping over that little more technical detail. So you have that gap between the superuniverse and the first outer space level. Which,
going on
no, that's what they're saying. Okay, just hold on. Okay, so there's this gap between the superuniverse and the first outer space level, and almost everywhere in space, space is filled with gas and dust, interstellar matter, intergalactic matter. Okay, this is a very important piece of revelation in here for astronomers. That there is a gap that's roughly 400,000 light years there that doesn't have any interstellar matter in it. Okay, that's going to change a lot of assumptions that are being made right now. Because you're looking out. So think about what this means. If you're looking out towards galaxies in the outer space level, and you're assuming that you're always looking through this pea soup fog. Okay, if there's a region where there isn't any, But you assume that it's uniform. You're going to over-assume. You know, you're going to assume that stuff is going to get dimmed by rattling through that mess more than it actually does. It's going to throw off some of your assumptions. There's a number of things like this that are not knowable by us, so they're revealed so that we have what we need to make the proper initial assumptions. Right now, a lot of our assumptions are in error, you know, and so our conclusions are false.
How does light pass through the
biases? Right, and that's the other, and that's the part that you were referring to. I was just going to bring that up. So even they, this is an important piece of information too. Even they are not totally certain about what happens to photons, say, as they go through that zone between the two levels. So you have a photon coming from, you know, Andromeda, say, and it's chugging along fine in pervaded space in the first outer space level. It's got to go through this quiet, you know, relatively quiescent zone and then back into more pervaded, you know, to us. And see, even they don't know exactly what kind of physics is going to be in play there, how that photon is going to be affected by that. You know, and see, this could lead to some difficulties in how well we can ever know some things. We might be able to indirectly figure out, you know, we might not know what is going on, but when all is said and done, it's like, well, it appears that whatever is going on there does this to it. I don't know why it does that to it, but it does this to it. So I have to take that into account. But just knowing it's there, and there might be some odd things happening because it's there, you want to, you know, they're telling you be on your toes in interpreting things, because even they don't quite know what the physics is out there. Okay.
So perhaps the speed of light is different than the quiescence.
Well, not the speed of light, because that again is not the kind of thing that we think of. Speed of light is a given, but you could have the frequency of the light being affected as it goes through there. It could be redshifted or blueshifted or not, or I mean, or why? Right. There could be refraction effects, or especially if it's a ragged boundary. I mean, yeah. See, so there's a whole bunch of things that, you know, are really mysterious, but the fact that they tell you that, they want you to keep that in mind and be careful about making simplistic assumptions if you're trying to understand what's going on in the outer space levels. Because everything you know about the outer space levels has to come through that zone to get to you.
Even Andromeda.
All information is distorted, you know, possibly, by that. Okay.
The central universe is the creation of eternity. Seven super universes are the creations of time. The four outer space levels are undoubtedly destined to eventuate evolve the ultimacy of creation. And there are those who maintain that the infinite can never attain full expression short of infinity. And therefore do they postulate an additional and unrevealed creation beyond the fourth and outermost space level. A possible ever-expanding, never-ending universe of infinity. In theory, we do not know how to limit either the infinity of the Creator or the potential infinity of creation. But as it exists and is administered, we regard the Master Universe as having limitations, as being definitely delimited and bounded on its outer margins by open space.
So from
number seven.
Right, that's number seven. Right, exactly. And notice one little key thing in there. Undoubtedly destined to eventuate evolve the ultimacy of creation. So of that compound hyphenated word, eventuate evolve, what's the root word?
Evolve.
Evolve. So it starts with evolution, and then eventuation is built upon that foundation. That's how so the fourth outer space levels are not just eventuated. I mean, we're watching them evolve right now. Okay, they start out as, they have a finite phase of evolution, which we're observing right now. That's the foundation of all. But at some point, just like all finite evolution, or all evolution because it's finite, all of that evolution will come to an end out there, just like it'll come to an end in here. And that will be the foundation upon which things will then be eventuated. And you can even wonder, it's like, well, are you going to have a significant evolutionary foundation in all four outer space levels? Or maybe just the first two and not so much. Maybe most of the third and fourth are going to eventuate. Or maybe it all is going to have quite a bit of an evolutionary foundation. It's just that it's going to come geometrically into existence. The closer the grand universe gets to being settled in light and life, the physical evolution out there, you know, it's been kind of arithmetically putzing along, but it'll start to go geometric and, you know, the whole thing will, you know, will evolve into place.
My understanding was that the four outer space levels are not going to be in time space.
No, I mean, they're in time space right now.
But
not even the super universe is going to be
into. The universe goes into light, full light and light.
Everything transcends finite time and space. Nothing will be in finite time and space anymore. In the same way that really, you know, Havona is, you know, the central universe really isn't, you know, in finite time and space. Okay, so you see, just notice little details like that. All right, let's get this next section in here too.
Two, the domains of the unqualified absolute. When Urantia astronomers peer through their increasingly powerful telescopes into the mysterious stretches of outer space, and there behold the amazing evolution of almost countless physical universes, they should realize that they are gazing upon the mighty outworking of the unsearchable plans of the architects of the master universe. True, we do possess evidences which are suggestive of the presence of certain paradise personality influences here and there throughout the vast energy manifestations now characteristic of these outer regions. But from the larger viewpoint, the space regions extending beyond the outer borders of the seven super universes are generally recognized as constituting the domains of the unqualified absolute.
Okay, just notice the truth point they threw in there. Stop just looking out there, they're saying, at those Hubble pictures, for instance, and going, wow, look at the cool blobs of matter. Okay? Yeah, they're cool blobs of matter. But there's something much more profound than that. Completely not directly discernible by the eye, but something that can be known more, even more definitively than what your eye thinks it knows. You're observing the mighty outworking of the unsearchable plans of the architects of the master universe. That's why you should stand in awe of the outer space levels, not because, you know, oxygen and nitrogen gas makes cool, you know, swirly patterns.
There's incredible okay? mind behind that.
There's some vastly transcendent stuff going on there that's completely inscrutable even to, you know, the high revelators. They just stand in amazement and awe. It's like, what does it all mean? You know? Okay? So they want you to, you know, to hold that thought. But notice, see, the bottom line there is, when all is said and done, it's basically like nether paradise. The upper surface of paradise is where the personality stuff happens. There's no personality stuff on the nether side, where the unqualified, you know, comes to the aisle. So to look out on the outer space levels is basically to look at the extension of nether paradise. Okay, but remember, the architects are those that oversee really bringing the tops, you know, the upper surface and the nether surface of the aisle together. Okay, they're the ones that go right up to impinge upon that fact that even for the high revelators, the substance of the aisle and the substance of the body, the eternal sun, are a difference in name only. Okay. So And just one little kind of advanced tidbit in here, where you can put two things together in the book. True, we do possess evidences which are suggestive of the presence of certain paradise personality influences here and there throughout the vast energy manifestations, now characteristic of these outer regions. You don't have to turn there, but I'll just refer you to, in the preface of paper 16 about the seven master spirits, you know, we're the ones that are the source centers for those seven segments. It says, all the after plans of the seven segments of the grand universe and even the correlative segments of outer space have been conditioned by the other than spiritual diversity of the seven master spirits of supreme and ultimate supervision. So no, that's kind of what they're alluding to there. They see signs of the outer, maybe only the first outer space level, you might guess, of some imprint of the seven segments out there. Some foreshadowing of the master spirits transcending the super universe supervision. Little hints of their footprint out there. Okay, so that's kind of, you know, the main thing that they're alluding to there about paradise, see, you know, paradise, master spirits, paradise personality influences. All right.
Although the unaided human eye can see only two or three nebulae outside the borders of the super universe of Orvantan, your telescopes literally reveal millions upon millions of these physical universes in process of formation. Most of the starry realms visually exposed to the search of your present-day telescopes are in Orvantan. But with photographic technique, the larger telescopes penetrate far beyond the borders of the grand universe into the domains of outer space, where untold universes are in process of organization. And there are yet other millions of universes beyond the range of your present instruments.
Okay, so now remember, this is, you know, beginning of the 20th century, is present instruments. Keep that in mind when you're reading this sort of stuff in the book. Okay, but let's get this. Okay, here's an opportunity to help with, okay, what exactly is the seventh superuniverse? Okay, so outside the borders of the superuniverse of Orvantan, okay, in the first outer space level, it says, with the naked eye, you can see two or three, and it's not nebulae, it's nebulae, okay, two or three nebulae. Okay, what are they? Okay. So you know you can see the Andromeda Nebula with the naked eye. Now that's the easiest one to see with the naked eye. That's one. Two of the two is not far from Andromeda, is the the Andromeda Galaxy and the Triangulum Galaxy, another spiral galaxy. Those are the two definitive ones that they're talking about there that you can see with the naked eye that are in the first outer space level, just, you know, within the first outer space level, you know, pretty close to the inside boundary of the first outer space level, Andromeda and Triangulum. Okay, and then if you have superb vision and it's super dark, maybe you can see a third. Okay, that's why OR3. Okay. A galaxy that's referred to as Centaurus A. Okay. That's the maybe third one they're referring to. Okay.
Know it was there, and then use a little bit of imagination.
Well, a lot of times, you know, if you look with peripheral vision, but those are the three, okay, Andromeda, Triangulum, Centaurus A, okay, and they're all not that far away, you know, they're, you know, definitely on the inside margins, you know, especially the first
year. Next to each other, kind of?
Well, no, I mean, spread out. Andromeda and Triangulum are pretty close to each other in the sky, but Centaurus is way in a different direction. Okay.
Centaurus A.
Okay. If you've seen pictures of it, most likely, it's a peculiar galaxy in that it has this massive band of dust stripped across it that's blocking the view. Mm-hmm. Okay. So it looks like this picture of this big glowing ball with this harsh, you know, lane of dust obscuring across the middle of it. Okay, that's Centaurus A. Okay, so see, Andromeda is in the first outer space level. All right, so that's you know, basically what you've got with the naked eye, and like they said, you know, it's you don't really see that much until you bring in you know, long-term exposures. You know, back in those days, it was a photograph. To get beyond that.
So the plane isn't held to as strictly in that outer space level.
I mean, it says seven galaxies are in the plane, but all that stuff out there is just whatever direction. Yeah. Okay. Just like the little stuff inside the here is in every direction, too.
Oh, okay.
You know, stuff out there. Yeah. Yeah, the little stuff out there is in every direction, just like the little stuff in here is in every direction. Yeah.
In the not-distant future, new telescopes will reveal to the wondering gaze of Urantian astronomers no less than 375 million new galaxies in the remote stretches of outer space. At the same time, these more powerful telescopes will disclose that many island universes formerly believed to be in outer space are really a part of the galactic system of Orvantum. The seven superuniverses are still growing. The periphery of each is gradually expanding. New nebulae are constantly being stabilized and organized, and some of the nebulae, which Urantian astronomers regard as extragalactic, are actually on the fringe of Orvantum and are traveling along with us.
Okay, so notice how they're reworking our terms. Again, what's an example of two of these close things? Two close galaxies that are part of Orvantum. That large and small Magellanic clouds, two little tiny spiral galaxies that are being drawn into the Milky Way and are starting to be torn apart. Okay, and there's a whole bunch of other little things like that around us. Okay, those are the two biggies. Okay, I mean, they are, you know, in a simple material sense, yeah, they're extragalactic. You know, they're not in the disk of the Milky Way. Okay, but in the sense of a super universe is basically that one big galaxy. They're not extragalactic in that sense. I mean, they're part of Orvantum. They're not out in the outer space level. See, so, I mean, like I said, see, I mean, there's just little things like that. See, are between the lines are pointing to the fact that Orvantum is basically one big galaxy. Okay, it's not extra Orvantum. It's not extragalactic. In other words, that galaxy and Orvantum are being, you know, connected as synonyms. And notice, see, they use the term island universes. See there, that beautiful term, which, you know, is, you know, I love to use all the time. This is a great term, you know, to think of it just philosophically. None of us are an island universe. We're only connected with each other through the individuality of the whole.
Even those, yeah, island universes are going to be being brought into the whole.
They're part of the master universe. They're part of an individual. You know, they are connected one to another through the individuality of the mother of the master universe. Okay, so see that they're trying to get that all sorted out, you know, and to get us to think less simplistically, physically, start to think in terms of that there is an individuality of a whole. I mean, it isn't just a random assortment of stuff just doing whatever. The Magellanic clouds, you know, are not allowed to just do whatever. They're part of Orvantum. You know, they're not going to find some way to get outside of this segment of the donut or anything. Yeah. They're traveling along with us. Now, there's a thing in this paragraph that has thrown people for a loop for years. Okay, right at the beginning there. They're talking about getting more powerful telescopes. Okay. The more powerful telescope references are linked together in the book. Two sections from now, the other shoe will drop here, other foot will drop, or whatever you want to say. of what they're bringing up here. This seems like a totally non sequitur, out of the blue reference. 375 million. I mean, why that? You know, and especially if you're, you know, if you just believe everything that you hear scientists say, you're going, well, that's like a complete lack of imagination. We think there's billions and billions of galaxies. Okay. What's up with that? Well, in two sections from now, we're going to see that they give you a distance out into the second outer space level, where basically everything is within that radius from us. I'm pretty sure that the reason this is here is to try to give us the fact points that we need to be able to clean up our assumptions about things. If they tell us indirectly that basically if you look within 300 million light years away from you, there's roughly 375 million galaxies in there. That's a calibration point. You know, as you try to sort it out, you know, if you think you've figured out where 300 million light years is, and you think there's 60 billion galaxies, either your count is wrong or your distance is wrong or something. It's connecting two things together so that we can get this pinned down to try to get our sense of where the proper distance is and the proper count. The main reason why we think that there's so many galaxies is because we look as deep as we can and we see a bunch of galaxies in this tiny little region of space, and we think they're super far away, and we assume that they're uniformly distributed in every direction.
I was just going to say, don't they make a 360-degree multiplication?
Yeah. They assume that it's spread over the whole sphere in that you know, roughly that density. And so that's where they get these really huge numbers. It's just by extrapolation. But first of all, you can't extrapolate spherically because it's not spherically symmetric. And second of all, they're nowhere near that far away. By and large, most of what you see is within 300 million light years. And then, you know, a little bit tailing out beyond that, in the outer reaches of the second outer space level. That's what you can figure out if you put all the pieces together in what they tell you here. And you'll see that in a couple sections. I'll point that out, how they give us that 300 million light year distance while referring to when you have more powerful telescopes. See, you got to connect those references together.
Are they giving us reference to the telescopes that we've experienced thus far? Or
no matter what we build, I mean, there's only so much stuff in the second outer space level, you know, and I mean, basically, the reasonably evolved stuff is about 375 million galaxies. And then there's a bunch of really embryonic stuff. You build more and more powerful telescopes, so you can see, you know, more and more of those, you know, little embryonic things out there in the outer reaches of the second outer space level. But that's all you're going to see. Because there isn't anything else to see yet.
Plus, we can only look in the one direction because we're here.
Right, but... Right, there's all these limitations, but anyway, that's we'll talk about that a little bit more when we in two sections when we get to that. But that's most likely. I'll leave a little bit of an out, but I'm pretty sure that that's what the point of this reference is.
Okay. The Aversa star students observe that the grand universe is surrounded by the ancestors of a series of starry and planetary clusters, which completely encircle the present inhabited creation as concentric rings of outer universes upon universes. The physicists of Aversa calculate that the energy and matter of these outer and uncharted regions already equal many times the total material mass and energy charge embraced in all seven super universes. We are informed that the metamorphosis of cosmic cosmic force in these outer space levels is a function of the paradise force organizers. We also know that these forces are ancestral to those physical energies which are present, which at present activate the grand universe. The Orvontan power directors, however, have nothing to do with these far distant realms. Neither are the energy movements therein discernibly connected with the power circuits of the organized and inhabited creations.
Basically, what they're telling you there is they've been told, so they know that it's proper for them to assume, so you can assume it too, like we currently do, that basically the physics out there is like the physics in here. That there's not some totally different radical physics going on out there. It starts with the force organizers and builds from there just like here. The only difference is it doesn't have beings controlling it beyond that initial force organizer stage, like they're saying. But it's still the same physics. You know, you get automatons and ultratons collect together into 100 unit packages, and you build atoms, and it's just like in here. That's what that is. So it's valid to extrapolate physics out there, but you might have to deal with issues like these, like the quiescent zone and stuff like that. Okay. But the general physics is the same, is what they're telling you there.
Are the force organizers, when it gets to the ultimatonic level, because that's normally where they hand it off in the grand universe,
They
don't hand it off.
They stay.
They stay.
Associates.
Are they associating automatons together then?
That just happens naturally.
So they kind of just let things happen naturally.
Right. They're just, remember, the associate transcendental master force organizers are taking it that last step of condensing the whirl that the primaries initiated, condensing that whirl into automatons. And then the ultimatons just do what ultimatons do. It starts with that curious huddling proclivity and goes from there.
But in our level, as soon as they're ultimatons, the power controllers come in.
Yeah, all the master physical controllers are all over it and doing stuff with it, yeah.
Interesting.
And see, that's
more laid back out there.
That's another thing that, see, is going to be very, that you have to really keep in mind about the physics within the Milky Way. We make a lot of assumptions about it being sort of free space, but it's really over-controlled space.
Very managed.
Very managed. There could be a number of things that we have way off because we don't know that a lot of things are getting distorted by just the presence of all these power beings doing stuff. I mean, this could have all kinds of effects. It might be why, for instance, we think that we're 20-some thousand light years from the center, but we're really 200,000. This could have something to do with it. I mean, there's a whole bunch of questions I haven't figured out about the astronomical distance scale. It's all messed up. The relativists give you all these points to clear it up, but I don't have it all sorted out yet. Okay.
Don't they tell us that the power beings, when they differentiate when they make Maracha material versus physical material, they start right at the ultimatonic level, I think, don't they?
We don't know much about what the modifications are. I mean, they basically start with material energy, and then they modify it and combine spirit energy in with it,
right,
to make Maracha substance.
Right.
But what exactly?
At a very basic level.
Sure, of course. Yeah, right. But, yeah.
Okay. Let's get back to the book.
Right. So you have the basic... You have the basic physics out there. It's just that it's not micromanaged like it is in here. Okay.
We know very little of the significance of these tremendous phenomena of outer space. A greater creation of the future is in process of formation. We can observe its immensity. We can discern its extent and sense its majestic dimensions. But otherwise, we know little more about these realms than do the astronomers of Urantia. As far as we know, no material beings on the order of humans, No angels or other spirit creatures exist in this outer ring of nebulae, suns, and planets. This distant domain is beyond the jurisdiction and administration of the super-universe governments. Throughout Orvantan, it is believed that a new type of creation is in process, an order of universes destined to become the scene of the future activities of the assembling core of the finality.
That's what I was talking.
And if our conjectures are correct, then the endless future may hold for all of you the same enthralling spectacles that the endless past has held for your seniors and predecessors.
Okay. We were kind of alluding to that. It's very obvious that things, the order of things have been taken up a notch. See, an order of universe is destined. Okay. So definitely that. And I just wanted you to notice one little technical point here in that second to the last paragraph, that second sentence in the second to the last paragraph. It says a greater creation. To notice the literalness of what they're saying there, okay? A little bit of Latin here, okay? Why do they call it the grand universe and the master universe? Okay? The word grand comes from a later Latin designation for the word great, where we get the word grand. Okay, so it literally means great. Okay. The earlier Latin word for great is magnus, okay, which gets turned, okay, if you, have you ever thought about the word master as an ER on the end? Like great going to greater? Okay, that's literally what it is. See, magnus is great, okay, and the word master comes from, you know, the Latin word for greater, okay? Master means greater. Grand is great, master is greater. You have the great universe and the greater universe. Just like you have Denver and greater Denver or things like that. Okay, you have, okay.
Bad example.
Okay, it's great. It's great and greater. Okay? That's literally what those words mean. Okay, so when they're saying a greater creation, yeah, literally. That's why we call it the master universe, the greater creation, the greater universe. Okay, so just, I mean, a lot of those details, you know, have gotten lost now. We don't appreciate, you know, that ER and master is literally like big, bigger, and biggest. Okay, it's the ER like bigger. Master. Okay? All right, so just, you know, see how they're using the language like that, just to bring it together. All right. Now that's exactly what we needed to do tonight. So it's going to get a little thicker past this. So get ready next time. But
why was this titled "The Domains of the Unqualified Absolute"?
Oh, I kind of that end of that first paragraph. Like the notion is basically out there. It's all about nether paradise, not upper paradise. You know, it's. Yeah, it's the domains of that which extends out from nether paradise, which is the unqualified absolute. Yeah. All right, let's just take a little moment here.